Welcome to episode 6 of the Soccer on the Rise podcast on Last Word in Sports. I'm your host, Thomas Neff, and the long-awaited return of this podcast. I'm pleased to be joined by Jason Lee of Tagger Tavern, Korean football digital site. Jason, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, man.
So, South Korea, they happen to be, worldwide, one of the nations that that has dealt with the best with this COVID-19 situation. What do you think's happened there? And does it have anything to do with labs and testing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the success of how Korea has dealt with COVID-19 has been well documented around the world. I believe that Korea and U.S. had the first official positive test on the same day. But Korea was able to deal with that situation really well because, like you kind of alluded to, Thomas, just the sheer number of tests that were done and the strict regulations that were placed by the government and the Korean people following those regulations, I think all contributed to the success of how Korea combated COVID-19. And I think we're seeing the fruits right now with Korea starting the opening of its leagues, its baseball and football leagues. So as a Korean myself, I'm extremely proud to see the efforts of my countrymen. And I'm just really positive.
Right. And the K-League, the first competitive league to return in the global stage, you know, it really had everybody's eyes on it. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Jason, but wasn't the opening match broadcasted and streamed, you know, YouTube, different other streaming platforms? I heard even at one point, you know, the BBC was carrying it. How many people saw that match?
I believe that it was streamed on the K-League official Twitter account, and I believe that it attracted, I think, up to 3 million viewers on Twitter, which is really, really good to see. Obviously, you know, K-League has never had that global attention that it sort of received on opening day. But I think, you know, with football fans starved for any form of football, I think that's why we saw the extremely high turnout on opening day of K-League.
Right. And that opening K-League, obviously, behind closed doors. But they had a Canadian on there, Daniel Henry. How do you think he did in his debut?
You know what? Donyell Henry actually received lots of positive praise from Korean media and fans. He plays for Suwon Samsung Blue Wings. They're sort of a mid-table team. You know, they're not really title contenders. But at the same time, they're a decent team with some quality players. And Donyell Henry was sort of hailed as the captain of the back three. And, you know, he's received lots of praise for his physicality and his work rate. And he has sort of become a defensive star in the K-League. We'll see if his production can continue to, if he can continue to maintain his production in the coming weeks. But his debut so far has been overwhelmingly positive for sure.
And as far as the national team goes, he is the only player that is currently playing in Asia. As much as a fit, where would you put the K-League as far as comparing it to other leagues?
I think we've actually had this discussion before, Thomas. But like I said, I think the K-League is a very similar level to the MLS, maybe slightly below. But we've seen players in the K-League move to Europe. We've seen multiple cases of players move to Germany, and we see Im Bum Hwang of the Whitecaps. Obviously, he's playing with MLS right now. He used to play for Daejeon of the K-League. So, yeah, I think it's one of the top leagues in Asia. And to see, and you know, Donyell Henry moving from the Whitecaps to Suwon MLS to the K-League, it's definitely not a step down. And if he has a lot of success there, I think, we can see him attracting attention from the top leagues in Europe.
And as far as that league goes, what do you think that is going to happen there? What's kind of the projection that they're saying there as far as continuing playing without fans?
Yeah, I think, you know, they had discussions about when the fans would be allowed to come back to watch the matches, but nothing concrete there yet. You know, the testing is still rigorous. I read that players – you know, get tested before and after games. And obviously, you know, the strict regulations that apply to the general public also apply to the K-League players, the refs, the coaching staff. But in regards to fans letting being allowed to you know, watch games, it's all quiet on that front for right now.
That's right. I saw a couple of pictures when they were doing the post-match interviews, actually. The reporter had one mic and the player had another, but they, you know, they kept 2 feet apart, and it's really interesting just so, because I have a feeling that, Jason, that as long as sports leagues are being responsible and they're proving to their local, provincial, federal governments and states that, they're doing things all right, then at the end of the day, more and more in leagues will follow and not just follow, but follow a specific protocol, right?
Absolutely. I think I actually reported it earlier on my Twitter account, but the K-League uploaded their protocol or manual of sorts to a World Soccer Forum so that, you know, leagues in Europe, leagues all over the world can sort of follow the plan that they have to combat COVID-19. And I think, you know, as leagues are able to share information, the more information that's shared, I think, you know, we'll start to see leagues open up again. I know that the Bundesliga has obviously started up again. The Premier League has opened talks to start up again. So, you know, it's really encouraging to see the K-League and the KBO, which is the Korean Baseball Organization, sort of be the pioneers for sports leagues around the world. And, you know, if leagues around the world can follow the successful manual that the K-League and KBO put out, I think we'll see sports return worldwide very, very soon.
That's right. It's going to be an interesting development, and you, myself, and so many others are keen to follow on how this goes into a domino effect. Jason, thanks so much for joining me, and was a pleasure having you on.
Thanks for having me, Thomas.
And now for my second guest, Bundesliga journalist Chris Williams, joining me all the way from the UK. Chris, thanks so much for taking the time.
Hey, no probs. Thanks for having me on.
So the first thing I'd like to discuss with you is obviously COVID-19 situation evolving around the world. Previously had a guest talk about the K-League. Second league to return is the Bundesliga. What do you know about, you know, COVID-19 in Germany, and why do you think it's come to this point that stuff is reopening and they're doing so much better than other countries?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because, I mean, here in the UK, the numbers are still pretty bad. And over certain parts of North America, you know, it's still pretty bad as well. But Germany has handled the situation quite well. So I think the latest figures, they had 177,000 confirmed cases, but their death rate is substantially lower than the rest of Europe. So they've recorded 8,000 deaths, which of course is, you know, a lot of deaths. But if you compare it to the United Kingdom, which is increasing every day, if you can compare it to Spain and Italy, and even France, you'll see that it's a much lower level. They have been doing a lot of testing in Germany, and apparently, you know, I'm not a scientist or I'm not a medical professional either, but you listen to the World Health Organization and they're saying test, which is what the Germans have been doing. They have the capacity to test 800,000 people a week. Their need is about 300,000 a week. So, I mean, that's about 500,000 tests a week going spare. And the Bundesliga needs 20,000 for the rest of the season. So it's really a drop in the ocean. So although it may sound a lot to, certainly sounds a lot here in the UK, it's absolutely nothing in Germany. And, yeah, the schools have reopened. Non-essential shopping's reopened. So, you know, you can go out and buy a new pair of trainers in Berlin. You can nip to the Saturn, which is the electricity shop, or the electrical shop, and you can buy yourself a new e-scooter. So non-essential businesses have reopened. And of course, football is a non-essential business, and it's one of those areas that's starting to come back. But of course, the reason football's been able to come back is because of the DFL protocols that have come in, the testing protocols and the medical protocols that have been signed off by both the German league, the DFL, the German FA, the DFB, and of course the federal government and all 16 states.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, like you mentioned it there, I think it's, they have a very, very good research science labs, and like you say, the testing capacity is like any other country. But like you say, Bundesliga football is a non-essential business. But it came back. It came back this weekend. What do you see from the games? And did you see players that were rusty, obviously playing behind closed doors? You could even tell that the substitute bench were players sitting on the stands and keeping 2 feet apart. Some people even said that that players were social distancing as they were playing. What do you see there? And football not only back for players, but broadcasters and reporters as well.
Yeah, so the league did come back. Obviously, there's a number of changes. The biggest change that everybody will have noticed and when they watched it is that it's being played behind closed doors. And I think that's the future now until probably 2021, I would assume, looking at the science and the statistics that the DFL have pushed out and that the German government have pushed out. So this is it. This is the new norm for the moment. It's not ideal, because I think anybody that watched those matches could see that although the level of games was quite high, that you know the play and the tactics were back, the fans do make the product that the league sells around the world. But, I mean, I watched the Ruhr Derby, Dortmund against Schalke, to kick things off. And after about 10 minutes, the lack of fans, it was obviously still there, but I personally was able to adapt to it. So I was just concentrating on the football. And then once the goals started going in, it was pretty much, you know, business as normal. But Schalke, you could say maybe they played football a little socially distant. I think they were a bit poor in defensively and they didn't really have much in attack, but that's been a Schalke problem. And yeah, you mentioned the substitutes, sitting just a meter and a half. So whatever that is in feet over in the States and North America. But yeah, they're apart. They wear masks. There was 3 different changing rooms used. There was 2 different buses. It's all about minimizing the contact and minimizing the transmission rates. So Germany requires you to wear a mask at the moment, and it also requires you to social distance. So the only people who haven't got that caveat are the 22 players on the pitch, which is why it might look odd when you see substitutes, you know, separated on a bench and traveling in different buses, but they can still do full contact on the pitch. That is the legislation that they've been allowed to come back and play in. So it's no real surprise as such.
Very good. And has the 5 substitution rule taken in effect?
Yeah, it was. The 5 substitution rule came in real handy. So the Bundesliga 2, the second division, kicked off before the main Bundesliga. And Heidenheim and Karlsruhe were one of the first teams to use all 5 substitutes. And then Schalke used all 5 substitutes in the half past 3 matches. That's the time in Germany they kick off. Yeah, they used all 5 substitutes. And I think we'll see that as it goes on, because there is a little bit of rustiness in some clubs and some players, and that's only to be expected. You know, they've been not played a competitive fixture for 66 days, so it's almost a closed season in essence. But, you know, we're into the last business of the 9 match days, and there's titles on the line, there's relegation, there's European qualification, should that happen next season. So they don't have the joy of being able to, you know, start slowly. There's 9 games to see who wins the title. So these 5 substitutions allow teams to rotate their squad a lot better, and it will help some teams more than others. It'll certainly help the top 5 or 6 more than it will the bottom 6 because of the strength they've got in depth. But yeah, it should help teams get through this little strange part of football that we're seeing for the foreseeable future at the moment, unfortunately.
Right, you're saying flexibility for the top, not so much for the bottom, but obviously this is a Canadian podcast. Alfonso Davies, how did he fare in your eyes against Union Berlin?
Yeah, I mean, I love watching Alfonso Davies play. I was given a heads up by him. I know a friend of mine covers the Vancouver Whitecaps, so I was made aware of Davies' skill and ability before he actually made that move to Bayern Munich. But to see him given his chance and to see him play as well as he does, I do think he's one of the best left backs in Europe at the moment, which I suppose would make him one of the best left backs in the world. He is very young. His pace is blistering. I think, you know, I've seen that personally. He just flew down the wing against Augsburg, and they pretty much copied it against Chelsea in that first leg Champions League game at Stamford Bridge. He was at it again on the weekend. I think he had the highest number of sprints across all players. So that was 20. He clocked the highest speed of the weekend, which was 33.83 kilometres. Apologies. You'll have to use Google to convert that into mile an hour, I'm afraid. But yeah, he is going fast. I mean, he is so fast that over a short distance, you know, Usain Bolt struggled to keep up with him. Obviously, over 100 metres, Usain Bolt would, I think, quite easily outstrip him. But over a short distance, what footballers are asked to sprint at, maybe 20, 30 metres, then, yeah, he's incredibly fast. I like him. He's got no fear about him. He just wants to drive up players. He always plays with a smile on his face. He's a real nice guy. If you speak to him in the mix zone, he's a full package. And, yeah, he's certainly someone Canadians can be proud of.
Definitely flying the flag in Canada, in Europe. And he's someone, like you say, who is evolving. Another player who is also evolving is Jonathan David. You know, he's been killing it in Belgium. He's been linked with many different clubs, specifically in Germany. I want to ask you about that. What do you think are the chances that Jonathan David ends up in the Bundesliga? How much truth is there to that? I know there was a list of teams that were interested. I know he might be linked to other leagues as well. What do you know, or maybe in the case, as any fan, just what we've heard from rumors, and how would David adapt from what you've seen and from what you know?
Yeah, I mean, he's another good player. Obviously, you know, Canadian again, and where he's playing at the moment, I think he's not. That's certainly not his ceiling level over at Ghent. I think he is a good player, and from what he offers from attacking midfield, I do think that he could play. He could play maybe further forward as well. I know he has that ability to play second, like a second striker and almost like a centre forward. I think the Belgian league has offered him the chance to showcase his skills. You know, he's got 18 goals, 8 assists in the Jupiler Pro League, and you know that's not. It's not an easy league as such. I think he would have a little bit of adaptation issues if he were to make the next step up like many players. So the difference between a Belgian league and a German league is quite a gap. So I wouldn't expect him to hit the ground running at the same rate that maybe Erling Haaland did going from, you know, the Austrian Bundesliga to the German Bundesliga. They're very similar leagues. So there would be a little bit of adaptation. You know, there's teams who are linked. Within there's teams in Germany, there's teams in the UK that have been linked with him. I'm always a little bit wary though of players making that jump a little bit too early. You know, I know he's 20, but and I know Davies is doing very well, and even Sancho is doing very well. But players tend to hit their prime around about 25, 26, especially with the nutrition and the fitness they've got these days. You know, they can play into their mid to late 30s. You look at Ronaldo, look at Lewandowski. They're all exceptional players later on in age. Thomas Muller's another one. So I don't think he should be in a rush to go anywhere. But I can see, you know, if he's offered a couple of clubs in the Bundesliga or maybe the Premier League, how he would do that. But I would urge a little bit of caution, because I think we all saw what happened to Christian Pulisic. You know, he was flying at Dortmund, and then he's had a little bit of a roller coaster since then, and he's moved over to Chelsea. And was that the right time for him to move? So I understand players are keen to make that move, but they need to find the right club. I mean, for instance, you know, Manchester United scouts have talked about him. I would say that is too big a move for him at 20, and not because he's not good enough, but just because of the expectation that would be put on his shoulders. And players, youth players, need to have the time to adapt. They need to have the time to develop. And, you know, unfortunately, they don't get that sometimes in the biggest leagues, because they're broadcast all around the world and people want to see the best of them immediately.
Right, and the Belgian league, you know, it's a top 10 league in Europe, and the Bundesliga is top 5. So if he does go to the Bundesliga, what sort of team would you like to see him with, you know? And as well as maybe because he has a French connection and he speaks French, and so many Belgian players have thrived in League One before heading on to stepping up besides the French leagues, considering you know, it's the fifth best league. What do you see him in, and what do you think could be the best fit for him in terms of, you know, taking the next step at the age of 20, like you said?
Yeah, I mean, if he was to come to Germany, obviously I know he's been linked with the likes of Bayern Munich, but he would, I think he might struggle to get into that team immediately. Davies is starting now quite easily, but you know, he's had to bide his time. He wasn't an instant starter when he arrived from the Whitecaps, but you know, the teams around a Bundesliga he could fit in. I mean, take out the top four. He will probably get a chance at somewhere like Bayer Leverkusen if they were interested, because you know, they have a lot of history of bloody youth players. The same with Leipzig, but I believe they've got a real good squad. They've got a real top squad at the moment. So where else could he go? I mean, he could go somewhere like Hoffenheim, who are used to developing players, or maybe even somewhere like Mainz, but they tend to develop their own academy players. But they do take other players on loan from around, you know, Europe's other top leagues. But I think he would need somewhere where he would get regular playments, and he wouldn't get that regular time at Bayern. He certainly wouldn't get it at Dortmund, I don't think. And maybe Gladbach would offer that. So yeah, I'd say Gladbach, Leipzig, Leverkusen, somewhere like Freiburg, he'd get the chance, Hoffenheim, even Cologne, or maybe even Frankfurt. But you know, they're a team that can have a good day and have a bad day and have a season of that. So he needs to be getting the minutes in as he can and when. And I don't think that would offer him with the top clubs. And if he was to go somewhere in France, well, he'd have the same sort of problem, I think, with regards to playing time. But certainly if he went to PSG or Marseille, he'd have to go somewhere like Rennes or Lyon, I don't think would be the right fit. So you're looking at a mid-table team, so Strasbourg, Bordeaux, Monaco, Montpellier, something like that. But I mean, if I was him, I wouldn't be too keen to leave Ghent at the moment, because he's getting the opportunities to play, and he's getting the goals and he's getting the experience. You know, he's played in the Europa League as well, in the Europa League qualifying. He's played 40 games this season, 23 goals, 10 assists. I would say he shouldn't be in a rush to move. He should look to develop at Ghent, and when he can do that for two or three seasons on the run, that would put him into 23 years of age and then maybe looking at moving.
Chris Williams, Bundesliga journalist. Thanks for joining me.
Cheers.
And now for my third guest and final segment of this podcast, I'm joined on the other line by JJ Adams, Vancouver Province and Vancouver Sun, Host Media.
Good morning, Thomas. How are you, sir?
Good, good. Happy to have you on. You know, JJ, it feels just like yesterday where, you know, we were in the press box for the Whitecaps opening game, no?
No, it doesn't feel like yesterday. It feels like decades ago. Like, it's been so long, but it hasn't really been that long. It's just everything that has happened between then and now, just it feels like a long time that has been crammed into a few short months. Yeah, it's crazy.
No, definitely, it's been definitely a roller coaster. So first thing I want to talk to you about is you did a piece on PFA Can, the professional players union, founded by CBL players. You know, in your piece, you gave a specific number of how many players had signed cards. You interviewed the legal counsel executive. And obviously, Marcel Dion, the president that was appointed. Can you tell me a little bit about that? And I guess, you know, obviously, we heard rumbles about this happening behind the scenes for quite a bit of time. Finally came together through the line because of the cuts that the CPL had to make, deferred. Just give me your thoughts on that, and I guess how do you see it going from now?
Yeah, I mean it was in the works for a long time, as you know, stretching back to last year, and they had planned to sort of take their time to really get a chance to reach out to all the players and let them know who they are, what they wanted to do, what they represented, what they could do for them and the league. And then when, of course, Sports Everywhere got shut down, it actually accelerated their plans, because all the various leagues started talking about wage cuts and deferments and rolling back. And for a lot of the players in the CPL, they're not making a lot of money. Actually, really very, very few players are making a lot of money. I mean, there are guys that are making – you know, $1,000 a month. There are guys riding the bus to get to training, to games. There are guys, you know, five in an apartment. They're not making a lot of money. And then for the league to sort of ask them to take wage cuts, it really alarmed a lot of them. And when the people behind the Players Association got wind of this, they accelerated their plan to try and get them some kind of protection, or at least a voice in how things were going to shake down, because the league made this the wage cut proposal without any consultation of any of the players. It even caught a lot of the teams by surprise. They were a little shocked that the league would take this step without having any kind of previous talks with the players or owners, instead of just coming down the pipe and saying, this is what we're going to do. And so once that happened, the PFA, you know, reached out to players to get their signatures to make them their official bargaining rep. And I believe the success rate on that was over 90%, and actually would have been even higher had some out of country players gotten a chance to sign their cards. So I think it's they're at the stage now where they have been ratified by the players, but not recognized by the league. And so that's the next step. I mean, the league is going to have to recognize this association as the binding bargaining representative for all the players. And then anything that they decide is going to have to be presented to them. Now, how that unfolds, those next steps, we'll see shortly. But I think this is a positive step for this league. It will, you know, make it more attractive for players coming from outside of Canada to come here, or even players who are here in Canada who are domestic players considering their next steps in their professional career. You know, playing in Canada would be far more attractive to them than to have to go overseas and play, you know, really small ball division soccer overseas, whereas they could stay home and have a solid league, a league that is on good footing and provides a good playing ground for these guys to develop as players.
Absolutely, you know, that's a fair point there. You definitely mentioned, kind of touched brief on it, that, you know, the next step is voluntary recognition. Do you think that voluntary recognition will come?
I honestly think it has to. I don't think the league really has any choice. Because it's such a new league, it's only a year old, and the second season, you know, we're all in the deep freeze right now. They need the support of the players. They're the lifeblood of the league. And if the players say, this is what we would like, then I can't see the league not have recognizing them, because from my talks with the people in the Players Association, they're not out to try and squeeze the league for more money. I mean, they even said they weren't going to have any collective bargaining talks until, you know, a year from now, you know, once the league is in a little more solid footing. So it's not like they're trying to come in and undercut the league. They understand that this league is an amazing opportunity for domestic players and domestic development for Canada, and is something that is vital. Like, I'm trying to think of the last time a team that made the World Cup that didn't have a domestic league. Like, it's extremely rare. So in terms of Canada's place on the world stage, the CPL is a huge step in the right direction. And to have a league where the players are happy and it's a successful league is going to be important to that. And for that league to be successful, they need to have the goodwill of the players, and the players need to have the goodwill of the league, because really it's a symbiotic relationship. They're going to make each other successful.
That was going to be actually my next question. Was going to be surrounded the award opportunity. Obviously, this league, it's a startup. It's a one-year-old league. You know, with that, you're going to have challenges. You're going to have investors, owners, put money in this league, and sponsors as well. But you don't have that 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50-year history, and that stability as well. So at the end of the day, you have to be careful as far as the budgets go and the spending capacity. Because I cannot see any of the clubs making money right now. But again, when this league was founded, they knew that they were going to have that. They knew that the goal was to lose the idea was to lose money in the first couple of years. And then, you know, when soccer became, you know, a top sport in this country, then to kind of then break in and then go from there. But again, the word opportunity. Every league has its own players association, the NHL, the MLB, NFL, et cetera, et cetera. I can go on and on and on all day about this. But yeah, as far as if this league didn't exist, I think it's fair to say that like half, if not, you know, I'd say half. I'm going to say half, not two thirds, but half of the players, especially the young players, really. And then the older Canadians that you know are playing abroad, were playing in North America, were playing in Europe, and so forth, that came home. But I'd say half of the players, you know, wouldn't be playing professionally right now. A lot of these players are signing their first ever professional contracts. So when something like this comes up, you know, you have players like in the board of directors, you have players that have played abroad and have dealt with their own players association, but you have 18, 19, 20 year old kids who, you know, just signed, who just put pen to paper in their 19th birthday and, or came straight from college or youth academy. So they don't really have, you know, used to familiar with that kind of system. But at the same time, is it fair to say that because of this league, it's a new opportunity for everyone? And realistically, you can't really go 100 miles an hour. You have to kind of take it slow and then kind of meet halfway.
Well, yeah, you were absolutely right. You know, when you talked about operating losses, like I'm not gonna say all the owners, but most of the owners in this league are very successful businessmen, and to be successful, you have to understand how business works. And they got into this knowing that they were going to lose money in the short term. Like, this is a long term plan. This is not a flash in the pan kind of thing. And you know, on one hand, I think that's probably positions the CPL well to survive the coronavirus pandemic and what it's done to sports around the world, because they were already prepared to have losses. I don't know if they were prepared to have losses quite on this scale, but they were prepared for losses. So, you know, I know there are teams in this league that are, you know, hemorrhaging money, like millions of dollars that they have invested into their various teams and facilities. I mean, you look at Pacific FC's training facility. It's a great example. It's a very nice facility, and it cost a pretty penny. You don't build something like that if you don't think the league is going to be there in a year or so. So they understood that, you know, they were going to lose some money in the short term. But, you know, over the next 5 years, especially with the money they got from their broadcast contract, it's going to help them survive to the point where they do have stability and they do have success and they are established as a legitimate league in this country. So it's just a matter of getting there now. And how you get there, I think you kind of need that players association on board to help things along, so you have a sense of what, you know, your employees are feeling. And on the other hand, your employees also feel protected. They don't feel like they're going to be screwed over, which, you know, a lot of them did when the league came down with this wage rollback and deferment plan that they came up with without talking to them. It, you know, it caught a lot of players off guard and left a bad taste in their mouth. So I think that's very important for this league. I mean, even if just look what is happening with, you know, the larger league, the First Division American League, let's call it an MLS. their players association is coming to bat for them right now, because they have also been asked to take wage cuts, and they have also been asked to figure out their return to play plan, which is a very kind of controversial biodome hub city kind of proposal where everyone will be quarantined for, you know, 2.5 months, 3 months in one city, you know, away from your families, away from your children, away from your friends, you know, not being able to go anywhere. It's a big ask for a lot of people, and the MLSPA is coming out and trying to make sure that anything happens, their members are protected. You know, their paychecks and their income isn't unfairly garnished. There is some kind of understanding that the players are what makes the league, and for a lot of these, you know, billionaire owners in the centralized league system to ask these guys who are making, you know, anywhere from 60,000 to, you know, over a million, there's a wide range in there to take these cuts. They understand that it's not easy for a lot of these players who are supporting families or away from home to see that kind of income drop. So, you know, a players association is vital to the success of any league.
Absolutely, and we also have to understand that at the end of the day, no football has been played, soccer, I should say, in North America. But that was actually something I wanted to ask you. We'll get to that in a second, moving away from the players' union. Now moving on to MLS. Certain rumors circling around that, you know, you mentioned it there, you know, moving to a neutral venue for 2 to 3 months, have all the teams there on quarantine, testing behind closed doors. You know, the first question is, will this model work? And second of all, how long do you think we'll see of any MLS clubs, you know, come back home, in the case for you in Vancouver, come back home and at least play in their home stadiums? Because I know, you know, MLS, with the amount of teams it has, over 20 plus, a lot of travel goes on. So obviously this makes the most sense in the short term, but obviously long term, you know, looking at the end portion of 2020 and, you know, 2021, you know, I just don't see how this could, you know, be a solution. But at the end of the day, you know, when you look at the United States, I mean, you're talking 1.5, you know, million cases of COVID-19. So it's not easy.
No, it's not. And the response to this in the U.S. and how each state or region is dealing with this, it is so completely varied and different in terms of effectiveness and level of cases. There's a lot of questions about Florida and whether their data is accurate. I'm not sure if you've been following the news reports today, but it sounds like, you know, the state has been perhaps underselling how many cases there are there. I don't know how that will affect the MLS proposal. I know NBA is also looking at playing in Orlando at the Disney complex, the ESPN complex. Remains to be seen. There's just so many moving parts here, and things are progressing so quickly and in unexpected ways that it's hard to predict. So I think the idea of a hub city or a biodome is the only kind of solution that makes a lot of sense, because it's the one that is most easily controlled, where the factors that could threaten it are more easily mitigated. So if you have everybody confined in one area, so we're talking players, we're talking coaching staff, medical staff, we're talking officials, we're not even talking about the team, you start talking about hotel staff. They're going to have to, you know, be quarantined as well. Anyone who comes in is going to be subject to a 2-week quarantine. So if you're going to try and rotate people in, they're going to have to come in and sit there for 2 weeks in a hotel room before they can do anything. That's a big ask. And that's not even going into the testing protocols. Like, are there enough tests? Do they have the infrastructure to be able to test, say, if it's like twice a week, like the Bundesliga is doing? Is there enough tests for them and the facilities for them to make these tests? I don't know. And, you know, will players want to be in one place for 3 months? I know the Whitecaps coach, Mark Dos Santos, tried to call it, you know, said, you know, players go away for the World Cup for 2 months. Well, you know what? Orlando is not the World Cup. This is basically I won't say a meaningless tournament, but this really has a very little effect on how the season would look in the end, like the results. It's basically a round robin and a knockout stage. It's there's not a whole lot for players to say, yes, I'm going to uproot myself from my home and my family and go to Florida, which may or may not be safe, and play for 3 months. And if I am going to play, they're asking me to play on reduced wages. I don't, that's a really tough sell. That is a very tough sell. So I'm not sure if it will come off. If it's still kind of up in the air. And as to whether, you know, we see teams playing in their home stadiums, you know, that is going to depend on each region. Like I said, it's so different everywhere. Like NYC, the Red Bulls in New York, I mean, that's one of the hardest hit places in the world. Are they going to feel safe playing in New York? I know California has a ban on any kind of pro sports until, I think, the middle of next month. So it's tough to say. And then up here in Canada, we've got the added issue of the border. That border ban that has banned any non-essential travel, non-commercial travel across the border has been extended. And I know there's a lot of resistance from the provincial governments to Canada opening up their border to the U.S. because the Canadian response to COVID-19 has been so superior to how they've done it in the States. I don't know if they want to open their doors to any more possible infections. They just might not want to do it. And then if there's, you know, any games being played in stadiums, what is that going to look like? You know, you're talking probably minimum of 250 people in these stadiums between security, media, the broadcasters, and then all the team staff and the officials and the building the facility workers. I mean, there's so many people that would have to be in there and tested. It's, you know, the way, if we were looking at it today, I would say no, it wouldn't happen. But, you know, down the road with the way things are changing, maybe. So honestly, I think we're kind of in a wait and see and kind of plan for a best case scenario if I was a league and go from there.
You know, professional sports is a non-essential business, and but there's always exceptions. They always exempt athletes for whatever reason, you know. You know, in cases like this, and you mentioned like the big challenge that is the border crossing because of Canada, you know, not being as bad as the U.S. because to a degree, you know, we're the worst in the world. But you know, to wrap it up. Two quick questions here. Is Orlando the right city? And obviously, if not, where other MLS city would you pick? And can MLS survive on TV money?
Well, I think the facilities in Florida, the reason every pro team is thinking of playing there is because the ESPN complex is so large, and it's proximity to relatively decent hotels where everyone could stay. I think that's why, you know, the NBA is talking about going there. The NHL had talked about going there. MLS is kind of their number one target city. The ESPN complex, of course, there's all sorts of corporate intertwining between MLS and Disney and ESPN, you know, it's almost might be a precursor to down the road in a few years when the MLS broadcast deal expires, you know, if it could be at start of a new partnership. We'll see. Are there any other places that they could hold it? I mean, California is another place, like Los Angeles. There's so many decent facilities in a small area that could work, whether we're talking about, you know, universities or the Rose Bowl or, you know, LAFC, the Galaxy. They both have fantastic practice facilities and stadiums to play in, access to broadcasters. So if it happened anywhere else, I would probably say LA. You know, maybe even I could see them doing, like, having the Eastern Conference play in Orlando and the Western teams play in LA, you know, just to kind of ease the load on a single city. I could see that happening. But other than that, I don't see any other place that could really play in the short term, apart from those two cities. You know, maybe, and this is a big maybe, Las Vegas. I'm not sure how many soccer facilities they have down there aside from UNLV and the USL team there. But I would say probably Orlando and Los Angeles are the two leading contenders for sure.
All right, that wraps it up. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And I'd like to thank especially my three guests today for episode 6 of the Soccer on the Rise podcast. We'll see you later. JJ, thanks so much.
No problem, Nev. Have a good one.